listening to WBTVLP Burlington, Vermont, broadcasting at 99.3 FM and streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers, and I am Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you will hear a new interview with the author Anne Hood, whose latest book is a memoir, Morning Star, Growing Up with Books. Here is a little background. Given that this latest book is a memoir, I actually decided just to read her bio as it exists on her website, which is in her own words, so you can get a sense of her voice. So this is Anne Hood's bio. I have wanted to be a writer for as long as I remember. My favorite books when I was a kid were Little Women and Nancy Drew. Later, I loved Marjorie Morningstar, Les Miserables, and Dr. Zhivago, obviously choosing books by size. A Rhode Island native, I was born in West Warwick and spent high school working as a Marsha Jordan girl, modeling for the Jordan Marsh department store at the Warwick Mall. I majored in English at the University of Rhode Island, and that's where I fell in love with Shakespeare, Willa Cather, and F. Scott Fitzgerald. When I was in the seventh grade, I read a book called How to Become an Airline Stewardess that fueled my desire to see the world, and that's just what I did when I graduated from URI. I went to work for TWA as a flight attendant. Back then, I thought you needed adventures in order to be a writer. Of course, I know now that all you need, as Eudora Welty said, is to sit on your own front porch. But I did see a lot of the world with TWA, and I moved from Boston to St. Louis and finally to New York City, a place I had dreamed of living ever since I watched Doris Day movies as a little girl. I wrote my first novel, Somewhere Off the Coast of Maine, on international flights and on the train to the plane, which was the subway out to JFK. It was published in 1987. Since then, I've published in the New York Times, the Paris Review, O, Bon Appetit, Tin House, the Atlantic Monthly, Real Simple, and other wonderful places. And I've won 2 Pushcart Prizes, 2 Best American Food Writing Awards, Best American Spiritual Writing, and Travel Writing Awards, and a Boston Public Library Literary Light Award. So, that's a little information about Anne Hood in the author's own words. When I spoke with her last week, we began by discussing her earliest relationship with books and reading. I hope you enjoy our conversation. You grew up in a home without books, but with a strong storytelling tradition. I thought that was really interesting. And I wondered if we could start by you talking about how this affected you when you were little.
Yes, I grew up in a large Italian-American family. You know, my grandmother couldn't read or write, nor could my great-grandmother, and I lived with both of them. My parents were, you know, blue-collar, kind of hardworking people, and they just weren't books in our house. We didn't sit around and read. But I lived with my grandmother in the house where she had raised her 10 children.
Oh, my gosh.
And they all still thought it was their house. So we had company. Every night, we'd eat dinner, and then they would start streaming in, which was sometimes delightful, and sometimes I would think, oh, just go away. But one of the great benefits of having such a large family was the stories. They would sit around the kitchen table, drink coffee all night. My mother will still at 11 o'clock at night look at me and say, should I put on some coffee? I'm like, I don't think so, Mom. But they would drink coffee. They were all big smokers, and I would sit in that smoky kitchen. Children weren't allowed at the table, and I would sit, like, you know, at a chair behind the table, and I would just listen to stories about their childhoods together, stories from my grandmother and her cousins about the old country, Italy.
Yeah.
Stories about the neighbors. In one house, everyone said there was a witch who lived in that house, and in the other house, they had a baby born that looked like a fish,
oh.
You know, had gills and scales.
Oh,
and I was fascinated. Yeah, there was a lot of kind of magical realism going on.
Yeah.
But, you know, they transported me back to Italy. I heard about the old country that they talked about with such love and passion. But it also involved just what my mother and her sisters had done as teenagers or as young children. And so it revealed both a family history, an ancestral history, some kind of wild stories, and I loved sitting and listening.
Yeah.
When I got old enough to join the table, you know, you had to be able to hold your own. You had to have a real story to tell, not the kind I tried at first, which was just sort of, and then this happened, and that happened, and then
yeah.
You get out of it, you know, you go back. You're not ready for this. But once I could, I realized, oh, you have to start with something to interest them right away.
Right.
And then you have to keep an arc to the story. You know, so they're saying, and then what? You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And it better pay off or you lost your seat again.
Yeah.
And so I guess I learned how to tell, how to write stories by listening to people tell stories. As I say in Morningstar, growing up with books, Truman Capote said that he grew up listening to his aunts tell stories on the porch in Alabama on summer nights. And I didn't have a porch, but we had that kitchen table. And I had the same experience.
Why? And it's so interesting that they didn't read books. Your family wasn't a family of readers. But it seems like that combination of their storytelling lessons, I guess I'll say, and your absolute love of books, which we'll talk about in a minute too. I mean, those must have come together to create just the perfect environment to learn how to be a writer.
Absolutely. You know, it's interesting because that noisy household provided me with stories and storytelling, but also the great desire for quiet. And so at some point I would always take my book and go up to my room and close the door and read. And I just have this wonderful warm memory. It isn't of one night. It's of many, many nights and many Saturday and Sunday afternoons being in my room lost in a book, but with the murmur of voices coming from below.
Oh, wow.
You know, it's just this lovely, like a Greek chorus almost.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's company without, you know, being hit over the head with it.
Exactly.
Yeah. So that's something else that really I was struck by because I interview writers. That's what this show is. It's always interviewing, mostly interviewing writers, sometimes agents and editors. But a lot of writers have told me that they didn't have a lot of friends when they were little. And you had a period like that. It sounds like that wasn't your experience later. But when you were little, you say you were a mostly friendless kid. And I wondered, what is it about friendless children who become writers?
Well, I think when you are not, you know, a part of a group of friends and going to for sleepovers and, you know, after school play dates. We didn't call it that back then, but what do you have but your imagination?
Right.
And I think that's what gets fed. I have a friend who's got a kid who's a little bit like I was and doesn't have a lot of friends. And I said, you've got to keep telling her she's going to be a great adult because she's reading and developing her imagination. And that's what I would do. You know, I would come home from school and do my homework, and then I would either get lost in a book or write a story. If I had read all the books that I'd taken from the library that week, then I wrote stories. So I'd have something to read. I made them up myself.
Yeah.
But I can still remember also developing, like, villages. I would make all the citizens of the village. I would create backstories for them and, you know, draw houses and how the blocks would be laid out. Or I went through a period of time where I ran a school in my head.
Oh my
and
gosh.
Here were the people in the first grade and the second. Yeah, so your imagination just gets, it goes wild. And boy, there's nothing like that. And sadly, we so over program kids these days that they don't have a lot of time to let that happen. We have to make sure to create that environment for them.
The book leads us through sort of an early memoir. I would say this is a memoir of your early life. And it takes us there sort of through the books that you read. So how did you come up with the idea to do this and the structure of a book per chapter, basically, and each book sort of goes alongside a bit of a lesson?
Yes. So my last novel, The Book That Matters Most, which came out last year, is about a woman in crisis who joins a book club as a way to get back into life and start over. And this fictional book club picks a theme every year. And the year she joins, the theme is the book that matters most to you. And each member has to choose one. Well, you would think I would have anticipated this question on that book tour, but I didn't. What book matters most to you, Ann Hood? And I would be like, and after I was asked it several times, I thought I better come up with an answer. And it was it was interesting that caught by surprise over and over. Some of us are slow learners. How many times what came out of my mouth was Marjorie Morningstar?
Oh, yeah.
And I thought, oh, my goodness, Ann, say The Great Gatsby or say something a little more highbrow, you know. But I realized it came out spontaneously because it had mattered so much to me. And so I reread it. I owned a copy. I plucked it off my shelf at home and reread it and found myself crying at the exact same spots that tore me apart when I was a teenager and read that book.
Yeah.
And so I said, why does this book mean so much to me? And I did some reading. I found, old reviews when it first came out and some really interesting essays about why that book matters and mattered to so many young girls. And for those who haven't read the book, it's about a upper middle class Jewish girl growing up in New York City who has very big dreams and wants to be an actress. And I realized when I was reading it, this is what a book can give us. I was a blue-collar Italian-American kid growing up in a depressed mill town in Rhode Island, but I had that big dream.
Right.
And I was Marjorie Morningstar. It was like Herman Wouk had looked into me. And when I reread that book, I thought, this is what books give us.
Yeah.
You know, you're reading, I read Rabbit Run and thought, I thought John Updike had known who I was. So this is the magic of literature, right? And so when I read that, reread Marjorie Morningstar, I wrote an essay and I shared it with my editor and my agent who said, you know, Anne, how did you become a writer? It's through reading. Reading books gave you the blueprint for those big dreams you had. Do you think you could write more about that? And the way I chose, so what I did was I went back and reread all the books. I mean, I could have done 50 books in this. You know, I chose 10. But I realized each of them had taught me something that I needed to know to do this thing I was dreaming of, which was to become a writer, travel the world, leave my little town behind, you know, and answer this yearning that I had from such an early age. Books helped me fulfill that. They filled me and helped me fulfill the dream.
Yeah.
And that's sort of how the book came about, just by rereading books. And oh my goodness, it was such an experience. Honestly, I would pick up one of these books and it would take me back to exactly where I was and who I was when I read it. What comes to mind, and it's a funny one I know, is the poetry of Rod McEwen.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
When I was rereading those poems, I just saw myself standing in that mall, where whatever Saturday, in that bookstore. It was a Walden Books, which I think every mall at that time had a Walden Books, and holding these slender books. I could remember the gray cover and the pink writing and, oh my goodness, I didn't have the money to buy them.
Right.
So I would go in and I would read them and reread them and try to memorize these poems. And they said to me, this is a poem doesn't have to rhyme like you're learning in school.
Right.
You know, it just changed the way I thought. And it was just such a wonderful experience to reread these books and revisit the me I used to be.
Right, absolutely. And that's an interesting one that you're talking about, the Rod McEwen book, Stanyan Street and Other Sorrows.
Right.
That's a good one. You fill that whole chapter with how to fall in love with language. And you don't necessarily start each chapter with the book itself. This chapter starts with onomatopoeia, your eighth grade
yes.
English teacher said. And it's great. It's just like, it leads us through this tiny little chapter in the history of your self. And you like were so excited by the idea of onomatopoeia. And then, you know, and then you find poetry and it builds from there. And it was really just a pleasure to read these.
Oh, yes. I so remember that English class because that's when we were introduced to simile and metaphor. And I remember the realization that that didn't just exist in a book of poems that you read at school. But here I am sitting cross-legged on my bed crying because I just had so much angst. I mean, nothing was wrong. and listening to Simon and Garfunkel.
Yeah.
And one of my favorite songs was I Am a Rock. And I remember sitting there crying and realizing I Am a Rock is a metaphor.
Yeah.
Sounds of Silence. Oh my gosh, there's so many similes in there. Personification. All the things I was learning, I realized it's all around us. And it opened me up to the poetry of our world, really.
Yeah. Now, there's a wonderful section about having grown up during the Vietnam War, and the fact that you were sort of too young to appreciate war fully until you read Dalton Trumbo's Johnny Got His Gun. And, you know, World War One was sort of a distant past that you didn't really understand. World War Two was the one that everybody talked about. Your parents talked about it. But Johnny Got His Gun helped you understand the reality of the stories you had heard. And that was just a great chapter because it really explained so well the power that books have to make obscure things real. Do you know?
Yes. Yes. How they help us connect our world to a bigger world.
Yes.
And to things that we don't even know about or understand. A book can serve as sort of like, a lifeline into other times, other places, and help us understand our world. And that is certainly true with that book. That book had such an effect on me. I hope everyone who's listening, if they haven't read it, goes out and reads it, because it really is an effective book about the horrors of war.
Right.
So, you know, the Vietnam War started almost when I was born. And so from the time I was very young, I remember eating my Jiffy Pop scorched, you know, in that pan in front of the 6 o'clock news.
Right.
And black and white images of the actual war was on TV. I mean, battles, people wounded, being taken away in helicopters. And it's horrible to say this, but I became almost inured to it. I don't remember sitting there thinking, oh, this is terrible.
Right.
It just was the background of my childhood. And then I read Johnny Got His Gun, which, as you said, is about World War One, but it's completely told in the head of someone who has lost everything. His sight, his hearing, his limbs. He is just basically has his brain.
Right.
And it takes you deep into his thoughts on war, his trying to make sense of why boys go to war, why they're sent there, what you know, the powers that be are deciding, and how that affects someone on such a personal level. And oh my goodness, I read that book and I could never see that background as background again.
Yeah.
I was like, those are boys like the boy in this novel. This is a different war, but all those people marching in protest on college campuses are asking the same questions that Dalton Trumbo is asking in this book.
Right.
And it just made me so aware of my war, the Vietnam War, but war in general, and that they're just young boys like my brother, 5 years older, you know, up for the draft.
Right.
It just made everything look different to me.
Yeah. And it sounds like it sort of introduced you, well, maybe just the awareness of war and being aware of your surroundings made you aware of protests and people protesting the war. And I really kind of had to smile when you talked about having missed the protest period around Vietnam and getting stuck with disco.
I just was in the wrong year. If I had been born 2 years earlier, it would have been better for me.
Yeah, you wanted to be a protester. But it was interesting to me that Johnny Got His Gun sort of made you into a progressive in a way that, you were from a very Democratic
yes.
family, but it sounds like that book really kind of like introduced you to politics too, in a way.
Oh, it did. I mean, I can trace what I believe today back to reading that book. Such is the power of literature, honestly. You know, we don't always pause to follow that thread back, but I did in writing Morningstar Growing Up with Books. That was sort of my task at hand, was to understand what these books gave me. You know, as you said, the book is divided into lessons, you know, how to love language, how to ask why, how to buy a book. And so I was able to sort of connect the dots between books and my life. And when I reread Johnny Got His Gun for this book, I realized, wow, I still am, the way I see politics and the world, I can trace directly back to that book, which I have to say was reissued because of the Vietnam War.
Okay.
Dalton Trumbo in the paperback that I had as a kid, and the one I bought to reread He has a wonderful introduction explaining that it was time to reissue the book.
Yeah,
and
did you happen to know his story when you were a teenager? Or
oh, not at all.
No.
Oh
yeah.
My goodness, no. You know, I had no sense that there was like a book review that came out every week, the New York Times book review, or anybody at that time, all major newspapers had. I had no sense of that. I had no sense that of the New Yorker or the Atlantic Monthly, which would, you know, review books and run short stories. I really lived in a sort of bubble of, I don't even know what to call it. I almost said anti-intellectualism. That's not correct, but I had no access to these things.
Right.
I was just a kid wandering the library.
Right.
And figuring it out for myself. It was so haphazard. You know?
Yeah. No, I just, because that movie came out recently and his story itself is so fascinating too. So,
The exact kind of story I would have loved as a teenager. You know, I would have loved to know that.
Yeah. Yeah. How hard was it to get the permissions to quote from these books in Morningstar?
I had to do a lot of trimming. I wanted to quote much more.
Yeah.
But in order for fair usage and all of that kind of thing, the legalities, it actually was trimmed back quite a bit, sadly.
Yeah.
And so in copy editing, the most onerous thing was too long, cut this, you know, and I was like, no, I want more.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's a legal read that you get and, they so helpfully told me to cut.
Yeah, that's hard.
I loved the book so much. If you saw the copies that I reread for this, you know, all these highlighted passages that I wish I could share.
Yeah. You can probably.
But people just have to read the books themselves.
Exactly. And that's true. You're sending people to read them. I'm curious, have you ever sent letters to favorite authors to thank them for their work? Or have you ever sent any of your books to authors who you do not know in hopes of sort of paying back the contributions they made to your life?
Wow. What a lovely idea. No, to both. And I wish I had thought of that. I never have done that. I certainly know as a writer that there's no greater thrill than getting a fan letter.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that when someone tells you the impact, you know, I love the ones that just say, oh, I read your book, The Knitting Circle, or whatever, and I loved it. I'm a knitter. But the ones that actually take the time to tell you why they loved it, you know, the impact, it makes you feel like all the time you spend alone in a room is worth it. You know, that actually you send books out into the world and to someone they matter is a great feeling. It's terrible that I never thought to do that.
Well, it's not too late. You can still.
I'm going to start now. I'm going to start.
And do you mind if I read just a tiny little section of the book and then we can talk about it?
Absolutely.
Okay, great. So this is from Lesson 4, How to Buy Books. In this lesson, we hear about your experience of reading Love Story by Eric Siegel. But actually, I want to read a section that's not necessarily directly related to that. It's about your living in a mill town. So along the river of my small town, mills that had produced textiles in the 19th century now stood empty, leaving most of the town unemployed. A Champlain grant to build a library led to breaking ground behind Main Street, where the movie theater showed XXX movies. Newberry's, the Five and Dime, was boarded up, and sleazy bars replaced what had once been fine clothing stores. To avid readers like Gloria Jean and me, the progress on the library seemed practically glacial. By the time it finally opened, we had read every Nancy Drew book and were ready to move on. Move on we did, Agatha Christie and Charles Dickens, Harold Robbins and Herman Welk, Victor Hugo and Evan Hunter. We read indiscriminately. We read everything. 3, 4, 5 books a week we read. And it goes on from there. Oh, and your mother says, a waste of time, my mother would say when I hung up with Gloria Jean after chatting about our latest reads. So I loved the way this book sort of paints a picture of your life. It's not just about you sitting in your room and hearing the murmur of voices at the kitchen table. You know, we get to see the whole town. We get to see, you know, your cousin, Gloria Jean. I liked how this really is a memoir. It's not just a love letter to books.
That's true. And that was, it was important to me to give context to the reading and to make this a memoir. As you said, I really wanted readers to see the teenage and the younger and into my teenage years, me, this town I grew up in,
yeah,
and also the world That was the world, the topsy-turvy world going on around me. I think every generation, of course, would say that, you know, they grew up in a unique time. But I do think the 60s and 70s, everything that had been held true for decades was turned upside down.
Yes.
And I grew up in a world that was constantly shifting.
Yeah.
And so I wanted readers to know that, to either remember it if they had experienced it, or if they were too young for it, to see it for the first time. You know, there were, my father would still wear a hat, yet there were men, younger men, you know, growing mustaches and those long sideburns and wearing ripped jeans. You know, my father would wear a suit if he traveled, right? And so, you know, I think kids who grew up then were looking at this and saying, where do I fit in?
Right.
Who am I? Am I going to wriggle into a girdle like my mother does every morning? Or am I going to burn my bra? I mean, honestly, you would have these such dichotomies.
And you had the great, you had this great image toward the end of the book. It's another moment where we're seeing a sort of hippie brother friend of a friend. And yeah. He's lying on the couch and he has sandals drawn on his feet so that he can go places barefoot.
Isn't that great?
That was awesome. So funny.
Yeah, it's because, you know, no shirts, no shoes, no service. Well, at least I have my shoes on.
That was great. I love that.
I love that you picked up on that detail, because that is something that has stayed with me forever. That guy's feet.
So funny.
But that was the kind of stuff, you know, I remember my cousins. I would see them driving up. You know, here's my little 5 foot nothing aunt at the steering wheel, and she had three boys, and they all had curly hair, and all I saw was hair in that car. They had these giant, you know, curly head kids. Oh my gosh, so funny.
Oh, that's great. Well, one thing I truly loved, and I have to say, when I started the book, I sort of thought I was going to be reading a book that I've seen before. You know, there are books by authors about the books that are important to them or that they recommend other people read. And what I really loved was that you treat all of these books with almost equal respect and affection to your initial reactions that you had. But, you know, you're a writer and a teacher, and some of these books aren't highbrow, as you said before. Some of them are not at all highbrow. And I just loved that you were just giving us this incredibly real story of what moved you as you were growing up and learning how to be a reader and a writer. Was that anything you had second thoughts about as you were writing and thought, oh, you know, maybe people are going to think that I'm not serious?
Just because I loved Harold Robbins.
Because you loved Harold Robbins. But even, you know, even love story yeah. isn't, you know, that's yeah. not taught so much in schools anymore, I wouldn't think.
And, no, yeah. I think several of the books are not going to be in your English class.
Right?
you know, I did not have second thoughts, and I did not even have to consider my impulse to include them, because my goal was to paint a picture of a kid, me, growing up without books, finding books on her own without guidance,
right?
Which is why some of them are not highbrow books, because I just plucked books off the shelves of bookstores and libraries, you know, without guidance. So, and to remind people that there is joy in a book that speaks to you, whether it is one you're going to study in a literature class or just one that you held in your own hands and it cracked open your heart in some way.
Right.
You know, they don't teach Marjorie Morningstar, but that book speaks to me.
Yes.
Now, rereading A Stone for Danny Fisher, I did have to struggle a little bit. No offense to Harold Robbins, who's, you know, written a zillion books that people love. And I kind of smiled a lot as I read it, because I thought, well, I remember reading this and not once thinking, oh, maybe this book isn't such, you know, such a good book. I loved it.
Yeah.
I cried at the beginning and I cried throughout that book. It really touched me. And that is a form of good writing. It's not perhaps what we study in literature classes, but to me, good books are the ones that touch us somehow.
Right.
You know, it's a very subjective thing. I wanted to be sure to make a real portrait.
Well, the other thing is that even though rereading these books brought you back to certain points in your life very vividly, you're not that person anymore. And you weren't at that time the person you were going to grow to become. And that person right. appreciates different, maybe, books on first read now. But
that's right.
It's still all fed into who you became.
That's exactly right.
So, yeah, the Harold Robin books, A Stone for Danny Fisher. I've never read that book, but you write about your brother's conversion to Judaism in the 70s, and how that book and also being Zatel in the high school production of Fiddler on the Roof all came together as your brother was converting, and it sort of introduced you en masse to Judaism.
That's right.
That was really interesting. And I remember being, and I'm a little younger than you are, but we're, I think, around the same age. I was so moved by Fiddler. And I wonder if you think this was America's first look inside Jewish life.
Oh, I do think so. I mean, we had, of course, at that time, writers like Philip Roth and Saul Bellow, you know, who were giving like an intellectual view into Judaism. But Fiddler on the Roof, and I remember, of course, I was in the play, but that same year it was a movie, and I remember going, we had it was called like Cinemax. It was a movie theater in the round, sort of, and Cinerama, what it was called. And we went to see it. Everybody in the play, it was like a field trip. We got to go to see this with the teacher. And oh my goodness, I did not know about shtetls. I did not know about pogroms. I did not know about the czar. And it forced me to ask questions about, what do they mean, you know, keep the czar far from us?
Right.
What do you mean the Russians are there? Isn't it Russia? I mean, I really, you know, there were some confusing elements that either the teacher who was our drama coach or my own research, you know, I used to sit in the library and look up everything.
Yeah.
Before Google, that's what you did.
Yes.
And educated myself, you know, in a very spotty fashion, but that's when I began to say, oh my goodness, I had no idea any of this went on. My town was 99.9% Catholic. It was populated by immigrants who came in different immigration waves to work in the factories. So we had the French Canadians, and then the Irish came, then the Italians, the Portuguese, you know, and then Polish, but they were Catholic Polish, not Jewish. And you knew where to go, but they'd say it's near the French church, the Italian church. The churches defined each little section of my town.
Yeah.
And so no one was Jewish.
Yeah.
So when my brother started dating in college, a Jewish girl, you could have said he's bringing home someone from Mars or someone from, you know, Antarctica. It was that foreign.
Right. Yeah.
To us. My parents knew exactly one person who was Jewish, and she was a friend of one of my aunts.
that was very funny. Because she's the one they would always invoke when they're like, we would have her over.
Jean Goldstein ate my meatballs, you know.
that was
but
great.
Anyway, so it was kind of an interesting, and you know, this is what's so great about reading and books. I often say sometimes they find us. We don't find them.
Right.
I read that book, A Stone for Danny Fisher. I was in Fiddler on the Roof at the same time. I was not that year saying, oh, this is so interesting. My brother is converting to Judaism in order to marry this Jewish girlfriend of his. And I'm in Fiddler on the Roof. And I've read this book. So I am now piecing together things about a culture I didn't know about. I didn't make those connections at that time.
Right.
Looking back, I was like, isn't that an interesting confluence of things?
Yes. Right.
You know, but here my brother is now observing, you know, a different religious tradition. And I'm like, oh, I just read, oh, that's what Danny Fisher did. You know, I mean, look at that, you know. Anyway.
Right. Let's see. You mentioned that in the book, you mentioned that John Irving always writes toward a known ending or sense of ending. And John Steinbeck did this as well. And I wondered if you do that. Do you know the endings before you write your books?
You know, I do. I really, you know, I was an English major in college. And of course, you know, an avid reader, that goes without saying. And one of the things I think as a writer is, as a reader, and as someone who studied, you know, English literature in college, what I know is that every story, in a way, is the Iliad. You know, someone wants to get home, whatever home is in your story, and that the protagonist is different at the end than he or she was at the beginning.
Yes.
And so if I can really, and I work hard. I mean, this is something that has taken me months for some novels. If I can isolate that beginning, then just because of what I know about literature, that reveals the end to me. Mm-hmm. My protagonist is going to be in a different place at the end.
Right.
Now, that's great. I like writing toward that. You know, it's those 350 pages in between those first and last pages. That's the problem. But I often, when I teach, ask students to pause. You know your beginning. You know, sometimes we have to suss that out, you know, over the course of many days or weeks or months. But you know your beginning. So in a way, you do know your ending.
Yeah.
And writing toward that, I love something John Irving said, actually, was, you know, he's a big fan of Dickens.
Okay.
And was very influenced by Dickens. And he said, look, there's a plot. How can you not know your ending if you've come up with a plot? You know, you've got to know plot points and highs and lows and the climax. You know, that's a traditional way to look at storytelling, but it works for me too.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Great. This is a little off subject, but you tell an anecdote that I was familiar with and you left off the ending. And I have to tell you, in case you didn't know.
Oh, dear. Yes, please.
The Joan Rivers bit about Saran wrap. Right? So Joan Rivers used to tell this joke about how she would greet Edgar at the door wrapped in Saran wrap. But the punchline was he said, leftovers again?
I didn't remember that. That's really funny.
So I had to tell you that.
Thank you. For I'll have to go for the paper bag and add it in.
I loved her. Okay. All right, I want to talk a little bit about your narrative voice in this memoir. I haven't read your fiction recently enough to actually know the answer to this question. I've read your fiction and I've enjoyed it very much. But to me, this narrative voice felt much more you and much more sort of personal. And I wondered if you were aware of that as you were working. Did that make it easier to write? Did it maybe make it harder to revise? What did that feel like as you were working on this?
You know, this was really such a joy to write because unlike a novel in which the narrative voice shouldn't be me, do you know what I mean? It has to either
right.
be the main character or the whichever point of view character I'm writing, and it has to shift according to whose point of view I'm writing. And so it's a totally different, hopefully, feel. This was really two me's. There was the teenager me.
Yep.
And there was the woman looking back with the vantage point of years, all these years. Carolyn Forshay, the poet, someone told me she advised, when you're writing about the girl you were, never forget the woman you've become.
Mm.
And that was kind of the two voices I had.
Yeah.
Honestly, rereading these books, they so brought me back to who I was. Parts of me that I had forgotten, or they have developed, you know, into an adult, so there's still the germ or seed of them, but it brought me back to the purer pieces. And I was a kid filled with angst, and I had a lovely life and a loving family.
Yeah.
But, oh, I just was an insomniac and overly romantic and overly sensitive. I often think of myself as just this giant nerve ending, you know, twanging around, you know, honestly. But I felt that again, you know, I was like, oh my goodness. But with the vantage point of the woman I've become, understanding why I felt that way, understanding what was keeping me up at night. I think a good example of how the two voices are so me, you know, in such the narrative style is at the end of the, chapter on how to buy a book in which I bought Love Story. But I ended that with me a couple years ago going through a divorce
right.
and having to pack up all my books. And the two me's merged in that moment, in that day, but also in the narrative of all the books I buy now, all the books I give as gifts, how moving and moving on in my life was so painful and necessary, all through the eyes of the kid who stood up at Walden Books, you know, and held Love Story for the first time.
Right.
You know, so that's to me is a good example of how the narratives merged.
And that actually leads us very naturally into my next question. You mentioned losses that you've experienced in your life, losses that you've written about in the past. You mentioned, as you mm-hmm. said, your divorce. And in that scene, you actually mentioned your daughter, Grace, who died when she was five from an illness that came on very suddenly, I remember.
Strep throat. Yep.
Okay. And then you also write about losing your brother. But anyway, you mm-hmm. write about these as part of this book, you sort of include them. They are part of your life, but you don't really expand on them or make this book about loss. And I just wanted to know if that was organic to how the book evolved for you. Did you decide very specifically to not expand on that?
It was conscious. You know, I wrote my memoir, Comfort, A Journey Through Grief.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the story of losing Grace, losing my daughter. And I've written many essays. Two different modern loves in the New York Times talk about that enormous grief.
Yeah.
And I would not ever say that it's now just a chapter or, you know, a subplot. It's, to me, always the plot, you know, the most important thing that
nice.
Ever happened and that I grappled with. But this wasn't a book about loss. Yet, to not honor that those losses would have been dishonest or mm-hmm. disingenuous, you know. So in that chapter we were just talking about, How to Buy Books, when I was standing packing my books, as so often happens when I think you move, it's almost like the people who lived with you in that house, their fingerprints are everywhere. And mm-hmm. the image of Grace when we moved into that house as a two-year-old, she used to always wear a tutu. Every day that kid had on a tutu. And I could just see her twirling. You know, we didn't have dining room furniture yet. We couldn't afford it. And so we had this empty dining room, and I stood where my books, the bookshelves were, looked into the dining room. It was almost like a whisper of her, you know, going
right.
past.
Yeah.
And I wanted, so that's the way the people I've lost appear, just how their losses reflect me now and how their lives impacted me. You know, my brother appears in this book more than I think he's ever appeared because he was there while I was growing up.
Yeah.
You know, he was, you know, in the room next to me, smelling like a boy.
<You know?
laughs> So that's what was more important. But I couldn't withhold that, you know, I lost him when I was 25. So,
yeah. Okay. Thank you. What are you writing these days, Anne?
So I'm so excited. I'm always, of course, in a new novel. They take between 2 and 5 years to write. So
okay.
It's called The Museum of Tears. It's a very young book right now.
Oh, wow.
But, so hopefully we'll be talking about it in a couple of years. I am also working on, and this has been a long project, and you'll know why when I tell you, it's tentatively titled Cooking Lessons. It's another memoir. It's a memoir through food.
Okay.
Talking about not such little essays, though, about, you know, M.S.K. Fisher, the great food writer, said, I don't write about food, I write about love. And in a way, that was my guiding force. There are essays in which food plays an important part of my life at certain times, my understanding of me and family and love. And then there is a recipe at the end. If you or anyone listening has read Lori Colwin's wonderful book, Home Cooking,
okay.
It's kind of structured like that. But I began writing these essays, I don't know, 8 or 10 years ago. So it's not a book I could just sit down and write.
Yeah.
But it's growing, and it's almost a fully baked book. So that should be coming out next. And to my great delight, I have a new YA book coming out in June.
Yeah, I read that you were doing a YA book. What's it called?
She Loves You, Yeah, Yeah, Yeah.
Oh, right,
so Beatles fans will recognize that.
And absolutely.
It takes place in 1966. It's about a 10-year-old girl who tries to meet Paul McCartney.
Oh, that sounds fantastic. Oh, my gosh.
Which was my goal as a 10-year-old. And so I gave my character better luck than I had.
Now, here's a question. Have you ever written YA before?
I have written a YA book that came out, oh God, it's been at least 15 years ago, called How I Saved My Father's Life and Ruined Everything Else. Came out with Scholastic. And I wrote a 10-book series for middle readers, so that's younger than YA,
yeah.
Called The Treasure Chest, in which kids time travel and meet famous people when those people were kids.
Oh, wow. That's fun.
Yeah, so it's really a fun series, and it was so fun to write because I am still that nerdy kid who loves research, and it was like doing 10 term papers on famous people that I admired. And kids love it. You know, it's sort of, if kids liked The Magic Treehouse, it would be the next series.
Yeah.
Kids a little bit older, you know.
Yeah, okay. All right, great. Now, so for people who are maybe tackling YA for the first time, what do you think is different about writing for that audience? Or do you not worry about it? Do you just write a book about a younger person and it'll come out in such a way that it'll appeal to a younger person?
Yeah, you know, it's more the latter, because I think if you try too hard to appeal, you sometimes write down to them.
Yeah.
You know, I think of my daughter, she's 13, and this summer she reads this series called The Warriors about a world run by cats.
Okay.
And it's about 40 books. But she also read To Kill a Mockingbird and, for fun, Fahrenheit 451.
Oh, wow.
So what appeals to young people? We can't guess. So
right.
I just develop a character of a certain age and tell her story. In fact, that first one I mentioned, how I saved my father's life and ruined everything else, I thought I'd written a novella for adults. I said, what am I going to do with like a 100-page book? So I turned it over to my agent, who's smarter than I am in these things, and she said, you've written a YA book. Well, if I had sat down to do it, I probably wouldn't have been able to, you know?
Yeah.
The only guiding principle that my wonderful editor at Penguin told me is, in YA books, the adult self never appears. So there's not a reflective voice or a sort of, it's just you stay in the head of that age and that kid.
Yeah.
And that was useful to me because I like to do that. Looking back now, I see, I like that kind of thing. But you don't do that in YA. No.
Oh, that's great. So early in the interview, I mentioned that your mom used to complain when you spent your allowance on Nancy Drew books and when you were wasting your money on books and when you were wasting your time talking about books with your cousin. So I am curious what your family's reaction was later when you became a writer.
The first thing I have to say is my parents were gobsmacked. Like, you actually did it. How? You know, we have no idea. Very impressed, very proud. I was so happy that my dad, who died in 1997, lived to see my first book published and a few after.
Yeah.
My first novel, Somewhere Up the Coast of Maine, came out in 1987. Oh my God, 30 years ago. It makes me cringe. But I was so proud and glad that they got to, that he lived to see that, because he was such an important part of supporting me, you know. My mom is a very practical woman. She, no nonsense, you know, and I would say until about 10 years ago, she would call me. I by that time I published, I don't know, a dozen books.
Right.
She would call me and say, the post office is hiring. Go down and take the test. You get paid vacations and a pension, you know, thinking wisely about my future and, you know, my retirement. And she's just that person. She finally stopped when The Knitting Circle was optioned for a movie.
Oh.
She, for some reason, that made what I do more tangible to her.
It was real,
even
then.
Though she has all those books lined up on her shelf, you know, something about it getting optioned validated for her. It's funny, isn't it?
Yeah.
But that's what kind of turned her over. And but it's, you know, it's still, and I laugh, she's 86 years old,
yeah,
still lives in that house where she was born, where I grew up, still lives there. It's the house my great-grandmother bought when she immigrated from Italy. But she's very still practical, you know. I'll say, oh, look, I have something in the New York Times. She'll read it, you know. Not easy to impress this woman.
Oh,
so she keeps
great.
Me grounded.
Oh, that's funny. Anne, I just have one last question for you, and I'm hoping it's not too big a question, but I'm wondering what it was like revising this book, maybe with editor's suggestions. I don't know what that process was like for you, but revising a memoir from the suggestions of the outside.
Yeah, such a good question. I will say that unlike novels, where, you know, the characters have been created out of magic dust, you right. know, out of the air. And the situations that I put them in are open to so many suggestions. Well, what if she chose to do this? Or could you make that ending clearer? When you're working with the facts of your life, it's a different kind of revision. They couldn't yeah. say, have her learn this sooner, or, you know, have her pick a different book. I mean, it's right. what it was. And what I found very interesting is my agent and editor each had a favorite chapter, and they were different.
Uh-huh.
And each had a chapter that they thought, could you replace it with something else? And they were different. So I kept them all in because I realized it was great for that. I was really glad that happened because I realized, wow, this is what it was, and people are going to respond more to some of these than to others, or get lessons themselves from them
right.
or not. And I liked that they had least favorite and favorites that were different.
Yes.
So the revision process was more in my hands. The choices were more in my hands than when I write fiction.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. Before we finish up, I just want to mention again, the name of the book is Morning Star, Growing Up with Books by Anne Hood, and published by Norton. Anne, thank you so much for speaking with me today. I really enjoyed reading Morning Star and talking to you about it.
It was a great, it was so fun talking books with you.
You're listening to WBTV LP Burlington, Vermont, broadcasting on your radio at 99.3 FM. And streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers, and that was an interview with Anne Hood, whose new book is Morning Star, Growing Up with Books, published by Norton. You can learn more at her website, annhood.us. So if you're enjoying the show, please consider liking it on Facebook, rating it in iTunes, or tweeting about Write the Book. Thanks so much. We are streaming on 99.3wbtv.org and broadcasting at 99.3 FM. This week's Write the Book prompt was generously offered by my guest, Anne Hood. It is based on an exercise with which she has had good luck, from the craft book What If by Anne Bernays and Pamela Painter. The exercise is called Write a Story Using a Small Unit of Time, and that's just what you do. You write a story and ensure that it takes place within the time it takes to bake a cake, or walk to school, or drive to the airport. Contain the story within a specific period of time in order to challenge yourself to fully craft a narrative arc without using, for example, years in your character's life to develop that arc, a beginning, a middle, and an end contained in a small unit of time. And it gives you an opportunity to give your character an experience and have your character change in some way, but in a short period of time. So good luck with your work in the coming week. Please listen next week for another prompt or suggestion, and I will be putting that on the podcast site as I do every week. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. If you like the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and tell all your friends. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. You've been listening to Write the Book on WBTV LP Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Have a great week.